Good afternoon, everybody, and welcome to event number 8. And may I also take this opportunity to thank the Arts Council of England, without whom, really, there would be a very, very tiny festival. Ladies and gentlemen, have you been looking around your home and thinking that something is not quite right, that something is missing? That the sitting room needs that special touch that will transform it? Worry no more. Just visit our sponsors for tonight. Butler and Sweatman, retailers of fine contemporary and traditional objects for the home. Our guest this afternoon is Peter Tatchell. He consistently and bravely errs on the side of freedom. He considers free speech is one of the most important and precious of human rights. This means that he has campaigned on behalf of diverse causes, including Aboriginal land rights, the Green Party, gay rights, the disestablishment of the Church of England, and the freedom to insult the Queen, the Prime Minister, the Archbishop of Canterbury, even the right of Cornwall to become independent. He has confronted apartheid, capital punishment in Iran, Russian LGBT propaganda laws, the National Front. He has even taken a stand against the LGBT community itself, with whom he so often campaigns, as is the case in Northern Ireland's Asher's Bakery case. He is tireless. It turns out that this man has had about 50 bricks and bottles through his window, 3 arson attempts and a bullet in the letterbox. He has been beaten about 300 times in 30 years, not least by Robert Mugabe's bodyguards and by some Russian thugs as well. We are very grateful to Nicholas Murray. He is going to be asking the questions, and we look forward to getting glimpses of various aspects of Peter's personality and life through the poems that he has chosen. Yes, I'm very grateful to him for stepping into Peter Florence's shoes, who was to be the interviewer, who had to stand down at the last minute. There can be no better interviewer, frankly, because Nicholas has known Peter Tatchell since they were both members of the Bermondsey Labour Party. And what is more and even better, Nicholas is a poet, a biographer, a journalist, a lecturer, a fellow of the Welsh Academy, who runs the poetry imprint Rack Press and writes the bibliophilic blogger Literary Blog, and is the author of 4 poetry collections and 2 novels, one new collection just out, by the way, called The Migrant Ship. There will be a period towards the end for questions and answers as well. So anyway, please welcome them both.
Well, thank you very much, and it's a unique opportunity for me to impersonate Peter Florence. No one has tried it before. Peter, it's fantastic to be talking to you again. We've fought a few battles in the past, and to hear your poems, your choices of poems, is going to be really interesting to see that wider side of your activities. And I'm particularly interested in your first choice, which is very, very appropriate. And I know that's a poem that I know many people in the audience will know and be very pleased that you're starting with. Yesterday, as you know, was the 100th anniversary of the Battle of the Somme. Those of us, I passed through Birmingham New Street Station yesterday, and there were soldiers, actors dressed in First World War uniform, walking about the platforms and the concourse. It was a very quietly moving piece of street theatre, I suppose. So, Peter, your first poem is, I think, going to be Wilfred Owen's Dulce et Decorum Est.
Yeah, the reason why I chose it was because, not to do with the anniversary, it's because my grandfather on my mother's side was a farm boy in northern Victoria, Australia, and he signed up to fight in the Great War. He had, I think, 3 weeks training in Melbourne before he was shipped off on the HMAS Ballarat to England. They were torpedoed in the channel by German U-boats. Fortunately, amazingly, every single person survived. Then he was given another 3 or 4 weeks training in Surrey, and then shipped to the front. And the first day over the top, on the very first day of the Battle of Passchendaele, he was shot through both legs. He spent 3 days and nights lying in a muddy trench before he was stretchered out. Amazingly, he survived. And eventually was shipped back to Australia, where he spent the next few months in a repatriation hospital in Melbourne. Now, my grandfather was very, very reluctant to ever talk about the war. I can remember as a young boy, I would always ask him, and he would always refuse. But I think probably after the 15th or 20th time, he eventually reluctantly told me about his experiences. And these were like, 30, 40 years later, he was choking back the tears. And what stuck in my mind is he always said, never let anyone tell you that war is glorious. It's evil, it's vile, it's disgusting. Do whatever you can in your life to avoid war. And of course, I had that challenge in my late teenage years when Australia was fighting alongside the Americans in the Vietnam War, and there was a draft for that war. Now, my inclination was anti-war anyway, but particularly against that war. We were propping up, the Australians and Americans were propping up a tyrannical dictatorship in Saigon, guilty of the most grotesque human rights abuses in the name of defending communism. So I refused to even register for the draft. I thought non-compliance was the way to go. And there came a point where if I'd persisted, I would have been jailed for 2 years. So I skipped the country and came to London. I'd always wanted to travel anyway, but that was the impetus for me to come here. So for me, that's why I chose this particular poem, and I think it has a resonance about the sheer brutality and ugliness of war. Of course, there are certain circumstances where war may be the lesser of two evils and may in extreme circumstances be justified. I'm thinking of the war against Nazi fascism. If Hitler had overrun this country, as overrode most of Europe, if Hitler hadn't been stopped and continued to commit those unspeakable crimes, then life would have been hell for millions and millions and millions of people. So I think reluctantly, possibly, or certainly, the Second World War against Nazism was justified. But even so, it was a lesser of two evils. War is evil. War is bad. Civilians always get hurt. People always become casualties. And often, and I think in the case of the First World War, the moral and political justifications are somewhat blurred. So,
right, I think you should read it. I mean, The title, of course, everyone knows, Dulce Decorum Est, is from an ode of Horace. Dulce Decorum Est pro patria mori. It is sweet and fitting to die for one's country. That's not the true sentiment of this poem.
Absolutely not. Dulce et decorum est by William Owen. Bent double like old beggars under sacks, knock-kneed, coughing like hags, we cursed through sludge, till on the haunting flares we turned our backs, and towards our distant rest began to trudge. Men marched asleep, many had lost their boots, but limped on, bloodshod. All went lame, all blind, drunk with fatigue, even to the hoots of gas shells dropping softly from behind. Gas! Gas! Quick, boys! An ecstasy of fumbling, fitting the clumsy helmets just in time. But someone still was yelling out and stumbling, and floundering like a man in fire or lime. Dim through the misty panes and thick green light, as under a green sea, I saw him drowning. In all my dreams before my helpless sight, he plunges at me, guttering, choking, drowning. if in some smothering dreams you too could pace behind the wagon that we flung him in and watch the white eyes writhing in his face, his hanging face like a devil sick of sin. If you could hear at every jolt the blood come gargling from froth-corrupted lungs, obscene as cancer, bitter as the cud of vile incurable sores on innocent tongues. My friend, you would not tell with such high zest to children ardent for some desperate glory the old lie, dulce et decorum est, pro patria morai. So I learnt that poem at school, like many kids, at about the age of 10 or 11. It always made a huge impact on me, particularly in the light of my grandfather's own experience. Mm.
Yeah, and I think it's a poem, I mean, Peter and I are almost exactly the same age, and we encountered it, as so many school children did. That was the classic poem of the First World War for many people. Given what you've just said, it might surprise some people that you have been through the gates of Sandhurst, am I right? To giving a talk or lecture, wasn't that right?
After the Bermondsey by-election, some of you will recall I stood as a Labour candidate there. And one of the reasons why I was blackballed by the Labour National Executive Committee was because I advocated extra-parliamentary action to protest against the policies of the then Conservative government of Margaret Thatcher. So I'd argued that it was fine to challenge the government in Parliament, but quite clearly Mrs. Thatcher had a huge majority of seats, not of votes. She only won about 42% of the votes, but she got, I think, about 65% of the seats in 1983. So I said, you know, that there needs to be a challenge to the terrible things she was doing, in particular, broken promises. She promised, the Conservatives promised, they would not, this is the 1979 general election, she promised they would not increase prescription charges, and then pretty soon afterwards they did. And a whole series of other things, terrible things, were done. So I'd advocated extra parliamentary protest, that is, protest outside of Parliament to challenge the government. And I argued for a mass march of the unemployed on Parliament, for a tent city of the homeless outside Parliament, and various other ideas. So this idea of extra parliamentary protest caught the eye of the military brass at Sandhurst, and one of them had the bright idea, let's get in someone to lecture to senior officers about the right of protest. Because they had lots of people lecturing about how protest was bad and wrong, and indeed the Army's Land Manual of Operations talked about and had contingency plans for the military suppression of protest in this country. If you read that, I don't know if it's still in circulation, but it was pretty shocking. There were clear plans by the military in coordination with the government to use soldiers to violently suppress even peaceful protests that were challenging the government. So anyway, someone invited me along and I did this talk. To my amazement, I justified on democratic human rights grounds the right to protest and that the Land Army Manual was against democratic human rights principles. And amazingly, I didn't get an entirely unanimous response, but I did get a standing ovation from more than half of the officers there. So that was how I ended up at Sandhurst. And I later, on the back of that, went to also lecture at the Army Staff College at Camberley, which is for soldiers, officers destined for the higher ranks.
Mm. And you wrote a book, didn't you, Democratic Defence, which articulated some of these alternatives to war.
Yeah. In 1985, I wrote a book called Democratic Defence, A Non-Nuclear Alternative, which was to try and set out an alternative to the nuclear option. And the basic ethos of the book was to look at the democratic history and traditions of the British Armed Forces. We're talking about World War One, commemorating World War One. What people forget, and is barely reported, is the huge wave of soldiers' strikes and mutinies that existed during the First World War, where soldiers rebelled against unjust orders to go to the front where they would be massacred. and many of them, of course, were shot. So it documented that. It also documented, during the Second World War, again, the democratic soldiers' movements in the armed forces, the Cairo Parliament in Egypt, the way in which in the Home Guard, which is mocked and ridiculed to the great shame of this country, the Home Guard was the greatest fighting spirit of the British people in our modern history. The Home Guard was the British people under arms. Contrary to the way it's portrayed, which is a portrayal of a remote rural area, most of the Home Guard were in the big industrial cities, and there were Home Guard units in mines, factories, and offices. And this was the British people under arms, the British people ready to resist Nazi fascism using the techniques of guerrilla warfare, pioneered by a British communist, Tom Wintringham, a very senior British communist, Tom Wintringham, who had captained the English battalion of the International Brigades in Spain, and had wrote the ideas and theories of people's war even before Mao Zedong, Ho Chi Minh, and others. And he sought to apply these to defend Britain and Europe against Nazi attack. He said, we need a professional army, but also we need the citizens under arms. And he set up the Home Guard with the support of Edward Hulton, who was the editor and publisher of the Picture Post, with his money, and was eventually the home, that because it was so successful and because Britain was so desperate, it was then taken over by the Home Office. But if you go to the library, try and look out their book, Democratic Defence, it tells this whole story, but also talks about democratising the armed forces and switching from a offensive long-range military capacity to a strictly self-defensive, non-belligerent stance.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, coming on to your next poem, one of the most memorable images from the scrapbook of Peter's life of activism was the moment when he climbed up into the pulpit with George Carey, the Archbishop of Canterbury, to interrupt his sermon for, you would say, good reasons.
I would say very good reasons. I mean, for those who don't know, at the time, we had tried for 8 years to meet with the then Archbishop George Carey over his strongly anti-gay stance. He was saying that gay people are not entitled to equal rights, that the law should discriminate, and that gay people were inferior. So we tried to have a dialogue with him. He refused. So after 8 years, we said, if he's not prepared to meet us, we've held out the hand to offer dialogue. He slammed the door in our face. We will go into his cathedral. We won't abuse him or insult him. We'll simply challenge and expose his support for legal discrimination against lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender people. That's all we did.
Yeah, exactly. So, just like that. So, yeah, you're no stranger to the Bible, which is my lead-in to the next piece of poetry, the song from the Song of Solomon in the Bible. You're going to give us a little extract.
That's right. I mean, I chose this one deliberately and somewhat provocatively because there are elements of the Song of Solomon which are really beautiful, poetic, and romantic. But there's also what is really borderline pornography. And the verses I'm going to read were for many years banned and expurgated from versions of the Bible. And you have to read it carefully and remember, this is talking in metaphors. You've got to think the symbolism of the actual words. They don't exactly mean what's literally written there. They actually mean something else. And it is an exchange between a woman and a man over a sexual tryst. So I'll read it.
Yeah. Do.
So I'll explain who's saying what as we go. So it begins with the woman saying, I was asleep, but my heart was awake. A voice, my beloved, was knocking. The man then calls out, open to me, my sister, my darling, my dove, my perfect one. For my head is drenched with dew, my locks with the damp of the night. I have taken off my coat. How can I put it on again? I have washed my feet. How can I dirty them again? Then the woman continues, My beloved extended his hand through the opening, and my feelings were aroused for him. I arose to open to my beloved, and my hands dripped with myrrh, and my fingers with liquid myrrh on the handles of the bolt. I opened to my beloved. So it's basically a description, a metaphorical description of a sexual act.
That's right. That's what these poets get up to, isn't it?
So the Bible isn't quite as chaste and pure and virginal as many Christians and scholars believe.
Absolutely. Peter, before we leave the topic of religion, I know from what you've written, from conversations that we've had, that in your childhood, your family were very evangelical, weren't they? And to what extent do you think that early experience contributed to your role as a campaigner and seeking to sort of change people's hearts and minds? Do you think there's any connection, or is it fanciful?
No, there definitely is a connection. If any of you have read the book or seen the film by Jeanette Winterson, Oranges Are Not the Only Fruit, that's a pretty good description of my family. They were Christian fundamentalists. Everything in our family life revolved around the family and the church. There was nothing else. The Bible was one of only three books we ever had in the house. My parents were extremely devout. They had no interest in politics, human rights, the community, none whatsoever. But the one thing they did teach me that I think probably has influenced and stuck with me is that the importance of doing what is right. They said, you must take personal responsibility for what you say and do. Don't follow the crowd. Don't go along with what's fashionable. Do what is right. And of course, they meant in a religious Christian sense. But I interpreted that much more widely. And then when I was 11, I remember seeing a report about the bombing of a black church in Birmingham, Alabama, where four young girls about my own age were killed by white racists. And my reaction was, first of all, how could anyone kill another human being, let alone four young girls, in church on a Sunday morning? I was so shocked. That really, really moved me. And that prompted my interest in the black civil rights movement, and in particular in Martin Luther King, because he was a Baptist minister, so I could relate particularly to him, given my Christian upbringing. But I immediately thought to myself, well, what Martin Luther King is doing is making Christianity a reality. For him, it isn't just a pious thing that you believe and pray and everything. It's actually something you do. You make those values of the parable of the Good Samaritan and so on, you make that into your life, and you strive to make that happen here on earth. So I made the transition through the Black Civil Rights Movement, Martin Luther King, to a social activism, Christianity. And but long before I'd ever heard of liberation theology, I developed in my own little tiny head the idea that Christianity, as I'd read it, should be about human liberation, about being my brothers and sisters keeper, about being a good Samaritan, about blessed are the poor, the meek, and so on. So although I'm no longer religious, those basic values help push me where I am and to some extent still guide me. I think those basic Christian principles, which of course are shared by other religions and also by humanists as well, those are good principles and values.
And I think that I would emphasize that, knowing Peter personally and in your role as an activist, it's that moral sense. It's that sense that there are certain values that you stick to, even if it makes you unpopular. One of the sins, I suppose, on the left sometimes is a kind of groupthink. Well, you know, let's toe the line because we don't want to upset X or Y. You don't care who you upset.
Well, I never go consciously to upset anyone.
No,
I don't want to cause people
offence,
but I'm prepared to take on, you know, people if they do things that are wrong and harming others.
Yes. So if you object to public execution of two teenage gay boys in Iran, and someone in Stoke Newington calls you Islamophobic, you you stick to your guns. That's the sort of thing
and,
I meant.
And it's quite obviously not anti-Muslim to object to an Islamic State which is killing other human beings simply because of who they love.
Right. Now, your next poem, Peter, you've done this deliberately to embarrass me. And there was no collusion. These are Peter's
choices.
This
is my choice before he was ever brought in to replace
exactly.
Peter Florence.
So I've just said that in case you think this is a cosy little stitch-up. But Peter has very kindly chosen to do an extract from a poem in my new collection of poems called The Migrant Ship. And it's from a longer poem I think you're going to choose from. It's a longer poem in about six sections, imagining the fate of some of the migrants that we've seen in the Mediterranean.
Yeah, I chose this because, you know, what is happening in Europe today with migrants fleeing persecution is just so profoundly shocking. Most of these people are not economic migrants. They're people who are fleeing extreme poverty and war, just as we would if we were in that situation. And, of course, we were in that situation. You know, think of all the thousands of children who were shipped off to America to escape Nazi bombardment, and the way they were welcomed by the Americans and given a new chance in life. Think of all the volunteers from countries around the Commonwealth who rallied to Britain's aid, sending troops to help us fight to defeat Nazi fascism. You know, when we needed help, others gave it. Right now, others need help, and we should give it. And to turn away people is just so unconscionable in Europe in the 21st century. We are the richest countries in the world. It may cause us some inconvenience, but we should make the effort and provide to ensure that these people who genuinely have suffered grotesque, monstrous bombardment in places like Syria, that they have a place of refuge. So this is why I chose that poem. And also, it also harks back to, again, to the 1930s. You know, you think what's happening now has, and what you read in the papers and what you hear from the UK Independence Party and others, it has echoes of exactly what people were saying about the Jews in the 1930s. The Daily Express, week after week, would say, too many Jews. We're overcrowded with Jews. Just like they say, we're too many immigrants. We're overcrowded with immigrants. And I just think, you know, it's a tragic that history is repeating itself. So anyway, let me read from Nicholas's poem, The Migrant Ship. We were too many, crowded to the rail, as the quay abandoned us, water widened. Don't ask if fear or hope drove us in the first days. Don't ask what thoughts skittered in our heads. Just say we wondered how long our food would last, how we might face the heat in that stinking hold. Each had his moment when the darkness entered into a personal silence no one else could share. I cannot tell you its smell, bitter taste on the tongue, the longing to retch when the stomach is empty. I was sleeping when the cries started. I woke to a panic on the hot deck, the engine silent and the crew cursing as the vessel slumped, a sick beast. One by one, we dropped to the water. Boys in a river pool splashing. But no shore neared. No watchers called a warning. Some sank without striving. Others, treading the water, inspected the ocean, its taciturn vastness. When the boats came out from the sleeping island, they handled us harshly, shouting in anger in a strange language. They hauled us up roughly over the harsh side, the ones who were left.
Thank you very much. Okay, let's move on now to your next choice. From a poem, how would you describe this? This is Edward Carpenter's Towards Democracy. A prose poem, or how would you describe the bit that you're going to read for us?
It's a gigantic book. A gigantic book of, sort of, I suppose, a combination of a borderline prose and poetry. And it is his sort of exposition of a manifesto for democracy, written in, I think, the late 19th century. Carpenter was a colleague of William Morris and other ethical utopian socialists. Fenner Brockway described him as the greatest socialist of the 19th and early 20th century. He combined not orthodox socialism, but an ethical socialism, segued with art, feminism, animal rights, and so on. He encompassed a huge broad spectrum of campaigns and issues and sought to synthesize them all together. One of his great laments was the direction of so-called human civilization in the industrial world. Both the way in which industrialization was despoiling nature and polluting the environment, and also the way in which it was creating a huge gulf between the rich and poor. So this next poem I'm going to read is called After Civilization, which is his lament on the direction of civilization and the way it has positioned the human race separate to and against nature, when he very much saw the idea that we are part of nature and that we cannot go against it, of what we are a part, that we must learn to live with nature in harmony and to share the fruits and bounties of nature with all humankind.
Okay. Okay.
So After Civilization by Edward Carpenter. There, in vision, out of the wreck of cities and civilizations, I saw a new life arise. Slowly, out of the ruins of the past, like a young fern frond uncurling out of its own brown litter, out of the litter of a decaying society, out of the confused mass of broken down creeds, customs, ideals, out of distrust and unbelief and dishonesty, and fear, and meanest of all, the stronger in the panic, trampling the weaker underfoot. Out of miserable rows of brick tenements in their cheap jack interiors, their glances of suspicion and doors locked against each other, out of the polite residences of congested idleness, out of the aimless life of wealth, out of the dirty workshops of evil work evilly done, out of the wares which are no wares, poured out upon the markets and in the shop windows, the fraudulent food, clothing, drink, literature, out of the cant of commerce, buying cheap and selling dear, the crocodile sympathy of nation with nation. Out of the litter and muck of a decaying world, lo, even so, I saw a new life arise. Slowly building, lifting itself up, atom by atom, gathering itself together round a new center, or rather round the old world center once more revealed. I saw a new life a new society arise. Man I saw arising once more to dwell with nature.
I mean, what strikes me about that is both the utopianism, which I think is central to any kind of progressive politics, isn't it? We have to have a dream that we're heading for, but also that concluding words about being at one with nature. And that's something that means an awful lot to you, doesn't it? I mean, you've been an active member of the Green Party, and it was no surprise to many of us when you switched from the Labour Party to the Green Party, because you've always been very strongly environmental. The planet, is that where, you know, the cutting edge really is now?
Well, my view is very simple. There's no point fighting or working towards a better society if the planet and the basis of that civilization, quote unquote, no longer exists. You know, the essentials of life, you know, clean air, food, water, and so on, the air we breathe, these are the vital elements, the building blocks of any society. And so, you know, if we're going to strive for a world that goes beyond the social injustices and inequalities that we currently experience, then we can only do that if we can have a habitable planet in which to build that great new future. And right now we are going towards the very edge and the uttermost limits of the biosphere, not just in terms of global warming, but a whole host of indicators, you know, the degradation of soils, the acidification of seas. If we don't do something soon, the basis for human life on this planet will be radically restricted, and we are likely to see potential catastrophe. And I read, going back to my biblical past, I reflect on there's parts of Genesis and Revelation, particularly Revelation, which talks about, you know, the cataclysmic end of the world. And you read those chapters and you can easily see, you know, how they could apply to the future of this planet if we don't do something. Now, unlike some people, I'm not a pessimist. I believe we can do something. Sadly, I think we have very few political leaders, either of the right or the left, who are taking the necessary steps. They're not educating the public. They're not making the case about why we have to act now. And this isn't, of course, just something for our country. It's a global problem, which is why global cooperation rather than inward-looking nationalism is more important than ever. We have to work together as a common humanity to solve these common problems of environmental degradation. Otherwise, we won't have a habitable planet for the future.
Absolutely. Well said. Okay, coming on to your next choice, which left me feeling slightly uncool, because I hadn't heard of this particular poet or rapper. You've of course crossed swords with some hip hop people in the past, haven't you, for the homophobic lyrics and whatever.
Sexist lyrics,
yeah. But this Tiny Temper is someone who you feel has ticked the right boxes.
Well, like me, he's from South London, so there's a certain South London loyalty there. I think he's one of the best of the new generation of hip-hop black artists. And he's had a whole series of big hits. But the one I particularly like is his duet with Kelly Rowland, Invincible. And this is not for any political reasons. It's just because at heart I'm a romantic. And I think he's hit the nail in terms of modern romantic poetry in this song. I think he's one of a modern Shakespeare in terms of love poetry. And, yeah, I suppose perhaps it touched my heart in particular because when I first heard it, I was in a relationship, a new relationship, and had all those buzzy feelings. And I thought some of the sentiments here in this particular song were very imaginative and sort of reflected the power and strength of love between people.
Fantastic.
Okay. So this is from the lyrics of Invincible by Tiny Temper. And it is the lyric of a man to a girl who he's in love with. I'm going to try and do it slightly rappy, but I probably won't succeed. Ah, yeah, they said we shouldn't. Ha, huh, they said we couldn't. Ah, look where we are. We've done what they said we couldn't. As bad as the odds were looking, yeah, we kept on pushing. And every time I nearly hit the ground, you were my cushion. There's evidence to prove that you were heaven sent, because when I needed rescuing, you were there at my defense. Girl, in you I find a friend. You make me feel alive again. Yeah, from the wildest water, ha, to the highest mountains, ha, you and I forever, through the driest deserts. You lift me lighter. Sorry, you lift... start again. I'll start that stanza again. I'll start the whole thing again, if I may. Sorry. One more time. So this is Tiny Temper from his... This is Tiny Temper's lyrics from Invincible. Ah, you said we could... No, can't do it at all. Tiny Temper, Invincible. Ah, yeah, they said we shouldn't. Huh, they said we wouldn't. Ha, look where we are. We've done what they thought we couldn't. As bad as the odds were looking, push, yeah, we keep on pushing. And every time I nearly hit the ground, you were my cushion. There's evidence that proves that you were heaven sent. Because when I needed rescuing, you were there at my defense. Girl in you, I find a friend. You make me feel alive again. Ah, from the highest water. Ah, to the highest mountains. Oh, I've done it again. Third time, I'll try one more time. If I've just read it, it wouldn't have the same thing. And trying to do it slightly rappy is a bit difficult for me. So, Tiny Temper. Invincible. Third time lucky. Ah, yeah, they said we shouldn't. Huh, they said we wouldn't. Ah, look where we are. We've done what they thought we couldn't. As bad as the odds were looking, push, yeah, we kept on pushing. And every time I nearly hit the ground, you were my cushion. There's evidence that proves that you were heaven sent, because when I needed rescuing, you were there at my defense. Girl in you, I find a friend. You make me feel alive again. Yeah, ah, from the wildest water. Ah, to the highest mountains. Ah, you and I forever, through the driest deserts. You lift me lighter than ever. I feel as high as a...
Keep going.
I'll just do it again. You lift me higher than ever. I feel as light as a feather. And when we're fighting together, we can take on the weather. I will keep you warm through every single storm you will ever have to walk through. I will go before you. I will be the voice when you need someone to talk to. Please don't ever doubt me. Let me reassure you. No matter where we are, no matter how far, our paths may lead. We don't need no shields, because love is the armor that we need. We're invincible. Should I actually play it, just very quickly? It might be slightly better, so
let me try and do it.
See if this works.
When we're fighting together, we can take on the weather. I will keep.
about me. Let me reassure you.
No matter where we are, no matter just how far our paths may, we don't need no shields, cause love is the armor that we need. We're invincible, as our protector. We're invincible.
Shoot with me against the world. They can't stop us now. We've come too far. We've worked too hard. We're invincible.
I think we've been present at the birth of an entirely new art form, Australian Herefordshire rap. thank you, Peter. Invincible. Yeah, it makes me. You've mentioned the Shakespeare. I think that line in the sonnets about so long as men have eyes to see, so long lives this, and this gives life to thee. There was that sense of that. Yeah. Another group of people who you have sometimes got the wrong side of, quite wrongly, because a lot of your work has been very brave and courageous work, is with the human rights of gay people, gay Muslims in this country. And you've really taken a lot of risks in helping those people.
Not just gay Muslims, but also women, secularists, liberal and progressive Muslims. So I've really tried to take on Islamist extremists in the same way that I would take on the far right, like the BNP and the EDL. And it's tragic to me that large sections of the left will not challenge these people who are as bad as, if not worse, than the BNP. They say that women who've had sex outside of marriage should be executed, should be killed, that executions should also be the fate of people who blaspheme, of Muslims who turn away from their faith, of gay people and others. And it's shocking to me that most liberal progressive opinion will not take these people on. They're allowed to speak openly at our universities, almost without challenge. And anybody who does challenge them gets branded as racist and anti-Muslim, which is completely untrue. We're not attacking the Muslim community. We're not attacking them because of their race. It's because they are fascists. They are clerical fascists.
Mm, absolutely. Well done. And also within the historic tradition of Islam, there is beautiful erotic poetry and poetry between both sexes. And I think that's what you're going to give us a taste of now.
Yeah, I've chosen two poems from the great flowering of Islamic literature and art centuries ago, partly because I want to challenge the Islamic orthodoxy that is so anti-gay. Yet at the time when Islam was so flourishing, homosexuality and same-sex literature was flourishing. And many of the greatest Islamic scholars and poets were gay or bisexual, and they wrote some of the most beautiful poetry and literature with themes about same-sex love. So I wanted to choose two of those poems. I've got to say that these poems use the term boys, and they don't mean children. They probably mean young men around 18 or 19, maybe the early 20s. But there's two different poems, one from Iraq and one from Ibn Malik. But I'll read those.
Okay, yeah.
So the first of these poems from the great flowering of Islamic literature is from Iraq. The author is unknown. It's called Naked Boy, and makes a mocking expose of one of the religious leaders who presumably railed against homosexuality in the mosque, but behaved very differently outside it. So it's really about partly celebrating his affection for someone of the same sex, but also exposing hypocrisy. Naked Boy. Imam Ghazali, who would often preach with holy spirit and inspiring speech, burned with desires for boys with pretty faces. He sought such lovebirds in the furthest places. Love smote him so for one delicious lad, such were the deep emotions that he had, that he set out to find this boy at Ray, 100 riders with him on his way. At last he saw the darling boy so bright, as he stood naked in the bath all white, his lovely body was, each slender limb. All overcome, Ghazali looked at him, madly in love with so much loveliness, gazing and staring at his nakedness. And those companions, when they saw him stare, observed his passion for the youth still bare, and tactfully withdrew and left him there. Then the second poem is Ibn Malik. It's called In the Mosque. I watch him stand at prayer in the great mosque at noon, delicate, slender and fair, more lovely than the moon. And as his body's bent, worshipping God, I plead, Allah, let him be sent like that to serve my need. So I guess these two poems offer a counter-narrative to the traditional Islamic one. You know, homosexuality has been central to Islam from the get-go, even though they decry against it.
Yes. And in fairness, many religious traditions have been less than friendly towards gay people. Yes. Okay. We're kind of gradually moving towards a moment where we want to give you a chance to ask Peter some questions and answers. But we've got one. This is Desert Island Discs, so there's one left. We've had seven. Number eight. I'm really looking forward to this because I don't know what to expect, because this is a poem written by Peter himself, and I'm hoping very much that you're going to sock it to us. Yeah. Do you want to say anything about it?
I wrote this poem in 1985. It was in the midst of the AIDS pandemic, when many of my friends were dying. And being non-religious, I wanted to write something that gave a materialist reflection on death, that looked at death in a different way from the way religion and religious people did. Because many of my friends were not religious, and they wouldn't have wanted a religious commemoration. So I wrote this poem really to give a materialist reflection on death, looking at death in a different way. This is a poem by me. It's called Death is Not the End. Death is not the end, but the beginning of a metamorphosis. For matter is never destroyed, only rearranged, often more perfectly. Witness how, in the moment of the caterpillar's death, the beauty of the butterfly is born. And, released from the prison of the cocoon, it flies free.
Good. Well, thank you, Peter, for a very rich and diverse and, we're all expecting, thought-provoking set of poems. Peter's quite happy if anyone has perhaps like to ask a question. He's up for it. Does anybody want to say anything?
Hello, hello. Hello, hello.
Sorry?
Hello, hello.
What were the other two books?
What were the other two books at home?
Sorry?
Other than the Bible, what were the other two books at home?
Hope.
At home.
At home, in your parents.
Said your parents had three books, one of which was the Bible.
It was the expurgated Bible they had.
An atlas. And Arthur Mee's Legend of the World, which was basically an encyclopedia of British imperialism. One of which claims was if every British warship was put end to end, they would stretch halfway around the world, which even as 10-year-old I thought was rather improbable.
Peter, I've become aware of a phenomenon this week where I've found out that two members of Parliament are married to newspaper journalists, national newspaper journalists. It struck me it didn't seem a very healthy situation. What's your thoughts on that?
Do you want to explain who you're referring to?
I think one had the surname of Gove. The other one was the... I read this morning, Eurosceptic MP for Peterborough, which happens to be the town I grew up in, and I can't remember what his wife's name was.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, of course, people are free to marry whoever they want. I'll defend that human right. I've got to say, with regard to Sarah Vine, Mrs. Gove's email that apparently was accidentally sent to a member of the public, I don't believe that for one moment. It is my belief that was deliberately contrived to aid his ambitions to destroy Boris Johnson.
So, Peter, the last week we've seen a lot of things happening politically, but really worrying has been this kind of outpouring of xenophobia and racism from a minority of people, but is having a very damaging effect on our community in Herefordshire. Even in Ledbury, there have been incidents. So how would you advise us to go forward in these times of difficulty? What would you say?
Well, of course, it's very difficult to challenge and stop those people who harbour racist and xenophobic opinions. You know, we can't be monitoring them around the clock. But I think when those incidents do happen, it's very, very important that we challenge it and we stand with those who are victimised. And I'm conscious that there's quite a big Polish community here in Ledbury and that they have been the targets, apparently, of some rather vile abuse and insult. You know, maybe holding a vigil in solidarity with Polish people in Ledbury. A candlelit vigil in the market square might be a good way to send a signal that there are people in this town and the surrounding areas who do not share these views and who stand with our Polish brothers and sisters and others from other communities who are living here, working here, paying taxes, paying national insurance, contributing to the economy. And I also add that on that question, let's not forget all the Poles who served in the army and the RAF during the Second World War.
Peter Tatchell, you've inspired huge numbers of people absolutely stupendously. Not to do the same sort of stupendous things that you do, but I mean just to try and be a bit more, to try and live up to those principles a little bit more in their everyday life. And I was interested to know, is there any book of poetry or any particular poet who you find particularly inspiring? And would you recommend any particular poem for people who are trying to keep on the right path, especially with a view to protecting the environment? Thank you.
I fear someone will ask this question. And the answer is, no, I haven't got one.
Maybe, you actually were talking about Edward Carpenter. I wondered if... Who is the Edward Carpenter of the day, do you think?
There isn't.
Isn't there a big problem between free speech, which I think you and I would agree is important, and censorship.
Well, absolutely. The principle of free speech is that even people who say disagreeable things or things that you and I do not like should have a right to speak their mind. Now, I would say there are some limits, but they're very narrow. I don't think someone has a free speech right to make up false, damaging allegations against another person, such as claiming that they are a rapist or a tax fraudster when they're not. That's an abuse of free speech. I don't think someone has a right to abuse free speech by indulging in threats, menaces, or harassment, like feminist campaigners who've been subjected to months of incessant misogynistic hate mail. That's an abuse of free speech. And also those who incite violence. You know, inciting violence to me is an absolute red line. When you incite violence, you intimidate, you destroy free speech because the victims of that hate speech, those threats, are afraid to speak out. And a good example is in Jamaica, LGBT campaigners there were subjected to torrents of death threats to kill them. And that meant they couldn't go in public to defend LGBT rights and equality. They couldn't hold public meetings. So the death threats against them actually diminished free speech because they couldn't participate. So those are my red lines. Otherwise, even in cases of people who say things that are pretty horrible that, you know, I disagree with, like homophobic things, unless they cross those three red lines, I think they should have a right to say it. But equally, we should have a right and indeed a responsibility to challenge them. And the most effective way to undermine homophobia or misogyny is by challenging those people. If you simply ban them, that doesn't end the ideas, it doesn't discredit the ideas. The ideas don't go away, they stay there. But if you can challenge them and counter them with better arguments, better evidence, then that undermines them. And I just think of the example of Nick Griffin going on BBC Question Time. You know, I actually felt I wasn't very happy about him going on BBC Question Time, but in the end, it was actually the best thing because Bonnie Greer and others tore him to pieces and exposed him and discredited him. So he actually came out worse. And if he'd been banned, that wouldn't have happened. So I think free speech and open debate are the best way to defeat and discredit bad ideas.
I think we've got one more.
Peter, could I please personally thank you for your life of protest and everything you've done for oppressed people, and then ask you, please, to share a glimpse of your thinking on the pros and cons of the individual protest and the collective protest.
Well, I think, you know, every protest should be for the sake of every person. When you campaign against something, you may be campaigning for a wide, broad issue, but always keep in mind the individuals. So every successful protest is a collective effort, but every good protest should be for the sake of the individual. Once you lose sight of the individual, then it's so easy for the ends to justify the means. So to take an extreme example, I actually think Stalin had a noble aspiration. But he said, at the end of the day, the collectivity comes first. The greater good comes before the individual. So therefore, we can sacrifice all these swathes of people for the sake of the greater good. But if he'd been thinking of each individual, of their life, he wouldn't have done that. So it's losing sight of the individual that that's often where protests can go wrong. And we see it, you know, contemporarily in some protests and some campaigns. You know, I've got a lot of respect for the Stop the War Coalition opposing the Iraq War. But I think they've gone very badly wrong over Syria. You know, they won't speak out against the Assad regime and its mass murder of Syrian civilians. They claim that the main enemy is US imperialism, so therefore the Syrian people have to be sacrificed for the sake of defeating US imperialism. And frankly, that's just downright immoral. What is happening in Syria today is the Spanish Civil War of our time. And the left, most of the left, is on the wrong side. Most of the left is silent and doing nothing to defend the Syrian people. And, you know, I'm appalled by the level of reporting in the mass media about the Syria conflict. What we never hear is about the hundreds of thousands of Syrians in the non-violent civil society opposition. Hundreds of thousands. Many towns and cities, even villages in Syria, are now run by local residents' committees. Democrats, socialists, secularists, who are building in their own way a liberated zone, free from Assad, free from ISIS, where they are creating the, you know, the seeds of a new Syria, democratic, equality, human rights. But we never see that reported. The heroism of the White Helmets, the Syrian civil defense, volunteers who are killed on an almost daily basis as they go into bombed out mosques, schools, homes, hospitals to rescue people. Just the other day, 2 days ago, 4 White Helmets were killed by Russian bombs and by Assad airstrikes. You know, Russia and Assad are terrorists on a par with ISIS. They are mass murdering innocent Syrian civilians. Russia is the enemy. Assad is the enemy. And why large sections of the left can't see this is absolutely sickening. Jo Cox, to her great credit, did see it, and she fought to defend the Syrian people against Assad and the Russians. But there's very few others who do, including many Labour MPs who ought to know damn better. Their silence is collusion. Now, I don't want to see a new Cold War, but Putin is borderline fascism. What he's doing to his own people in Russia and what he's doing to the Syrian people, what he's doing to people in Ukraine and Crimea, is completely against any left-wing liberal humanitarian value. And why don't we see mass protests? Stop the war. Stop. They say stop the war. What are they saying about they wouldn't even support a no-fly zone in Syria? They dismissed the Syrian civil opposition as CIA stooges. They remained silent while the massacres were taking place in the Ukraine. I don't think the Ukrainian government is perfect, but boy, I know who the real aggressor is there. I know what's been happening in Crimea since the Russians took over. Look at the suppression of journalists, human rights defenders and lawyers in Crimea since the Russians took over. You know, the left is destroying. This is the left in this country. I hate to be pessimistic, but one of the reasons why the left makes no progress is because they've got double standards. They condemn rightly British and US human rights abuses, but so often remain silent about human rights abuses by others. You'd think that the left would be outraged that trade union leaders are being imprisoned and tortured in Iran as we speak. Where are the left-wing protests to defend those trade unionists who are dying in Iranian prisons under torture? You don't see it because their logic is the main enemy is US imperialism, Iran is against the US, therefore we must defend Iran. I don't agree with a war against Iran, but I do believe Iran is a major human rights abusing country. And what it is doing in Yemen and Syria is an outrage. It's a new form of imperialism. Iranian troops are fighting in Syria, killing Syrian civilians. We need to call that out. All I want is consistency, is that imperialism takes many different forms. Of course, there's a tradition of US and British imperialism, but there's also sub-imperialisms like Iran. They need to be called out. Russia needs to be called out. What Pakistan is doing in Balochistan and Sindh provinces needs to be called out. What the Indonesians are doing in West Papua needs to be called out. These are enemies of human rights and democracy, and the left should be against them just as much as anything the Americans or British have done in Iraq or anywhere else.
Okay.
Thank you very much, Peter. I mean, that last contribution explains why we hold Peter in such esteem and why a cosy little rounding off for me would be superfluous. So thank you very much for coming.
Yes, I'd like to take this opportunity to thank Nick as well for those gently probing questions, and to thank Peter as well for opening up, and it was such an inspiring and revealing event. I know you all agree. On your way out, by the way, do pick up one of these, and if you are, as I expect most of you are, interested in the issues raised by Peter, please consider joining the Peter Tatchell Foundation online. He's an excellent blogger, by the way, as is Nick. You can also buy some books down at the bottom there by Nick, and also HWAT, which is the anthology, Ledbury Poetry Festival's anthology, 20 years of poetry in Ledbury. All proceeds go to the festival. Anyway, usually there's a gift at this point, and we hand over a gift to the guest, and I've forgotten to bring it. But it is a bottle of cider and a bottle of delicious apple juice, which I will hand over to you at hospitality later. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you very much, and thank you, Peter and Nick.
Can I just say thank you all for coming today, and I hope that something of what I said made some sense. Can I just reiterate, some of these flyers are down the front. I've got a very small human rights foundation which does a combination of work here in the UK and around the world. As Peter said, on the back it tells you to sign up. It's all free, but please consider joining our human rights community. We do lots of issues that are little known. A little while back we did a really powerful personal testimony from an Arab human rights activist in Iran, telling his personal story of his arrest, imprisonment and torture. Stories that are hardly told and hardly reported. So things like that, and supporting campaigns of human rights defenders around the world. If you sign up, you'll receive copies of that and information about that. It's all free, so please sign up. And if you are able to, please consider making a donation, because we don't get any organized funding. We're really struggling. So if you can make a donation, on the back it tells you how as well. But thank you so much for coming, and good luck to all of you. Thank you.